not a friend but an enemy, enticing me to rebel at the offer. But it is a bribe I'm no longer willing to accept. The price is too high, a disappointment that takes far too long to dissolve the pointless reasoning. I know the path too well. Yet conflicting beliefs continue to collide, attacking each other with logic, and when the truth is so far beyond reach, no theory can be fully denied. So the cycle continues. But each time it is with less intensity and with less emotion, for no sky can remain clouded forever. No mind conflicted for often.
Alright.
Great, and next we have Rev Earhart.
Poem for a mercy song. Crisis what crisis, the management clear. And as I sit here in my chair, I think we haven't the nerve to read there, but they have, and they will, so please take care. Lines of chipped dialogue intertwined with swathed diamondback rattlesnake skin. Will you take it on the chin? When do we begin? And please inform my next of kin. 9 miles of magic back to a side street swan song of bombshell blonde and ravishing raven-haired beauty. Then 7 miles of magic more to the foreclosed foreshore and the moon-bleached sand. Now I'm hungry, now I'll eat, now I'll take the shoes off my feet. Now I'm hungry, now I'll eat, now I'll take the shoes off my feet. The philosophy of the albatross sweeps us out to sea, gold-flecked peaks and velvet troughs slopped with diamond-backed rattlesnake skins. Will you take it on the chin? When do we begin? And please inform my next of kin. Now I'm hungry, now I'll eat, now I'll take the shoes off my feet.
Alright! Next up we have Gerald Heffernan.
I'd like to read a short poem and then a longer poem, is that okay?
Yeah.
The first poem is really about how Damien Hirst drives me to drink. the title of the first poem is "The Physical Impossibility of Death in the Mind of Someone Living." Silence like rain is falling like tears like Captain Dog until I cannot drink anymore and am drowned. the second poem is a relatively much longer, and it might take maybe a few minutes to read, so I hope you bear with me. And the title of the second poem is "You are such a good example of contemporary manners, the painter and the invisible demon." Mm-hmm. Understanding imagination has to use the faculty of knowing what it is, the rational process. You don't need to learn what you already know, but how can you inquire about what you don't know, and therefore how do you know what you say you know? Direct perception, apprehension of knowledge happen upon that use of rational means. Meditation, it glares the sense of senses to a point where you lose control and in essence meaning. Reduced to a dog-like state, you react to stimuli like an untrained animal. Engage in that contemplative dialogue with your senses with a mind to enhance your increasing understanding. What does that mean? How do you do it? Memory and experience. Experience is organic. It grows and changes over time. This is heat-changing, probably. Over experience, over general narratives and codes are not actual. If the sun and moon didn't rotate in a pattern, imagine how you would see things then. Is your experience only relevant at the point of its experience, or does it stay true forever or longer? Why do memories often not run in chronological order? Why do dreams make sense when you're asleep but not when you're awake? Imagination. How do you know you've really imagined something? Could it be something, some distant memory half-remembered? Could it be you visualizing your feelings? My mother always said, or said at least once, that what you feel is what you feel. But can you trust your feelings? And why does what she said, which I regard as some kind of wisdom, not explain that? Do we imagine a lot of things we don't realize, like a linear narrative to our lives? Probably not. Why does all this seem so charming? I don't know. I don't think there's enough reality in this thought to lead to a better work of art. Why not explain what it matters to you know when you're imagining? Where is the invisible demon? we probably imagine a lot of things to be true and real when they are not. America is not really divided into all these different states. We've just a big mass of land. In fact, there's no America. The day isn't divided into hours, the week into days, or months into weeks, or years into months, etc. Feelings. With that being said, so far important, if we can't even understand what we're feeling, what is cute, happy, sad, free, inside out, strange, oppressed, melancholy? Cute, happy, sad, free, inside out, strange, oppressed, melancholy? Cute, happy, sad, free, inside out, strange, oppressed, melancholy? They can't be just the way we look at life, can they? Could they? Why does it have to be more than one answer to everything? Couldn't other people just be wrong? Am I answering this question because I haven't survived genocide or something else is awful? Can we ever really know what it means for God to be transcendental? Obviously not. All these words have all these different meanings. Could you ever begin to understand what I mean or what I'm saying, especially if I read it to you as an attempt for myself to come to some kind of knowledge through intuition? Love. What is so great about love? Why do we look for it all the time? I think, therefore I am. Is sex really important at all? What is so great about depression? I relate, therefore I am. Freedom. Can someone be free themselves, by themselves? Free from what? When you realize that what I'm saying doesn't mean anything, and nothing really means anything, can you be free then? If you are, what are you free from? Are some restrictions freedom? Probably. Standing still. Nothing ever stands still. We are all composed of constantly moving subatomic particles, and we don't know where we are exactly or how fast we are going. Light travels as a wave and as a particle. What the hell? When I punch your heart in the face, my particles bounce around the air particles and suddenly move. And all that, can you really describe that to some kind of moral value? What really holds all the particles together? I relate, therefore I am. If the universe is so infinitely large and we being fast and not a cent there, we're only a vestige of light hidden in a small ball in the dark corner, not to mention how cruel and desperate this light is, does it not seem like that we're some kind of byproduct accidental of a larger plan and force or inherently forgotten and significant? Probably not. Why do people only ask big questions and think these thoughts when something bad happens? Painting. Painting is abstract. Does it not make sense that a concept should also be abstract? Aren't all concepts abstractions from the real world, and when then realized as an art object, go back into the real world and they're no longer abstract? Can you call an abstract painting abstract? The process of creation. It involves means and paint and at the moment an idea. I think about how the idea could be visualized by thinking while I am working. Some people call this intuitive because I accidentally hit upon something when I am engaged in the process of the actual painting. I call this an accident. Sometimes I call them a happy accident. The painting can mean this to you and this to her and this to him and that to her and so forth. Can we honestly say it means anything? Can an object possess meaning? You hold the meaning yourself separate from the object. If it doesn't mean anything, what is its function? Can a painting teach? Can you bring to it anything other than what you already know? Can it show you anything you don't know if you hold the meaning yourself? You don't need to learn what you already know, but how can you inquire into what you don't know because you already know it? And therefore, how do you know what you know what you say you do know? I don't know. Does a painting have an emotion? Can I create something that lives? I don't think so. Could I really? Even if I figuratively paint it, does the painter relate? I relate. Therefore, I am.
Thanks very much, Charlie. I now feel confirmed on this liking day later. Okay, that's the last call, everyone. So please. Right. Next up, we have Mary and Casey.
The bedfellow. My name is Gideon Phillips and I'm more dead than alive. The morphine keeps the pain away from my head, but not my heart. I've heard news that my dear wife, Rose Elizabeth, has wronged me, nay, is wronging me. That in effect all her movements and transactions are a lie. That everything we have together, love, trust, intimacy and marriage, is a lie. The pain of this is killing me more than the cursed wasting disease that my kin have suffered from all through the centuries. David, my brother, stands at the bedside. Naked hatred lies on his face. Naked hatred for Elizabeth. Wearily up my hand out to take the letter. It is of David Thomas, Elizabeth's letter. It is unmistakably her handwriting, her loops and flourishes, as different as Elizabeth herself. Exhausted, my mind begins to wander. I can see my wife so clearly, a bundle of fiery emotions, long black hair and coils, deep-set blue eyes, petite, but a force to be reckoned with. Such passion. Even now I know she's pacing outside the door, resenting every moment that David spends with me on his own. My brother interrupts my talk with. She does not know this man for long, a month at most. A surge of anger overtakes me. I feel like launching my fist in David's face, with a supreme effort I control myself and simply smile. I know David's aim, to get the will changed, and my accounts and trust, all that I've worked for, left to him instead of Elizabeth. I know that he would follow my wishes. He did not have the wit to do aught else. I read the contents of the letter, or rather note. This is simple, my dearest. The doctor has confided that he should be dead by Friday. And then I'm to Paris, my darling, with the knowledge that your love is a wealthy woman. Until then, au revoir, my sweet, your loving Elizabeth. I feel pain in my left arm, and I suddenly realize that I'm behaving like a brute. My jaw has my arm clapped, and my teeth are bearing down on my flesh, biting it. I feel that I will choke with emotion. My brother is looking at me with real anxiety. He is afraid I will die before I change my will. Even now, he has it open on the bedside before me. David, I've no liking for this brother of mine. We were never close. I think of Elizabeth again, and my heart feels as if a knife is cutting it into shreds. David is looking worthy at the door. I know that deep down he hates my wife, because he fears her. He could never understand a woman like her. I push back the bile that rushes to my throat. What understanding do I have myself of such a woman? I have such illusions of her deep love for me. I have foreseen how after my death she would pine so dearly for me, that in my deepest regard for her, I felt that somehow, without me, her life would start slipping away from her. Life slipping away. Suddenly I remember years ago when I had finished my fellowship at Oxford. I had celebrated by traveling with friends to Morocco. One night I had left my friends, intending an early night. I took a short cut back to the hotel, down the back streets I ventured, though I had been warned that as an Englishman and stranger to these parts, I should not dare to leave the central area. A few yards in front of me I could hear a man begging for his life. I recall that one man held the victim on his knees, and the other held a large stick over the unfortunate's head. Without thinking of my own personal safety, I ran at the two men, brandishing my old cane in front of me. In that split second, the victim became the victor, because I saw the two men run from him, screaming in terror. I had never heard screams the like of them. The man that I tried to save was no more than 4 feet, and looked to me older than time itself. He spoke to me in excellent English. All he said was, I will grant you just one wish, sir. Call on me when you need it. My name is Carew. With that, he passed into the shadows and left me. I had forgotten the episode, because as soon as I returned home, I had met my darling, Rosa Elizabeth. I had nothing to lose. Wearily I wished, Carew, I want to punish my wife. Let me see her with her lover in Paris. Let me be with them. As if on the wings, the answer came, granted my friend. My heart gave a sudden lunge, and instinctively, I knew I was dying. My last moments were of David entreating me to live, and Elizabeth running towards the bed. I did not meet her eyes. The next thing I knew was that I was in a room with Elizabeth. She looked a picture of vitality and beauty, and I could see that she was preparing for bed. No doubt he was in the lobby and would join her soon. With a deepening hunger, I watched her pull the sheets back and slip into bed, and suddenly I knew what I would do. There was a soft knock at the door. Giggles and greetings of alluring innocence regaled him as he quickly undressed. I got into bed before him. All I shall tell you, my dear reader, is that the night was not that night of passion that they had hoped for. Whenever she touched him, I pressed next door to him in the most obscene way imaginable, and did so for her. There was no captivating surrender for him, and no enchanting captivation for her. I thought of that. The next day saw two woeful strangers going their separate paths. I rejoiced. I'm still with her, and yet her life is slipping away. Not from love, but from anxiety and fear. She's alone, and she's unhappy. And yet sometimes, when she calls at a window, or puts a hand to her hair, My heart softens, and I feel that I have forgiven her. I pray that her death will be hastened, and soon she will join me in the Valley of the Shades.
All right.
Thank you, Miriam. Okay, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 more readers left, and less than a half an hour. So I'm going to have to ask for one long poem, two short poems, or maybe a page and a half.
What's a long poem?
A long poem is...
It's a short poem, really.
It's as long as a girl's skirt, is it? I don't know. 4 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes, please. So, next up we have Colin Sully.
Right, two short poems. These two poems that I wrote recently. And the first one, it's just, I was in a pub recently with my family, three small girls, and then this older man who had a few too many drinks just came along, so this is it. Mercy by the Lee. He was sozzled, flailing his arms at passers-by. 40 years in the Mercy, for fuck's sake, why? And your heart. The other men at the bar ignored him, or at best gave a passing nod. A well-dressed man, but incoherent, sipping beans. Are these yours? He approached, smiling, wavering from side to side, challenging gravity. 3, 4 grandchildren, and one great-grandchild. He produced the picture. And who's the oldest here? I'm very old-fashioned, boy. She's a boss. I only saw her in midnight news. My wife arrived and turned her eyes to heaven. I'm very old-fashioned, missus. Will you have a drink? Later at the bar, he was swaying still as he offered to pay for our coffee. Fuck you all, says he, with a dismissive wave, after being ignored once more by the other clientele. 40 years at the Mercy. I wrote a book about it, I did buy Mercy by the Lee. And this is then just about my 20-year-old daughter. It's called Isabel. I heard you prancing around the room, in and out of drawers where you shouldn't be. Making light noises with your mouth, whispering names, little mysteries. You talk to children who aren't there, peppier chats with fairy tales. Who's that princess arriving late? She's always late. She's always late. She hardly cares. You found a comb and a pointed hat, wrapping a scarf around her neck. 10 little fingers begin to play a ghost piano that's almost real. You close the lid and lock with a key, and hide it away for another day, under a shelf of a flat-screen TV. You know it's safe, so the fairy's there.
Next up we have Bree Buffley. The first one's called Words in Your Hand. Sand slips through fingers, glittering constellations. Sky falls on chicken. Next one's called Snow. Snow sprinkles like talc from sky onto world's new skin, dressing the windows. Window shopping. You window shopping, but for the cheapest bargain. I squint through your pain. Sentinel. Trees stand sentinel over silent movie screens from flying soldiers' feet. Clutch. Birds flying to rows of roads dip deeper, overtaking bosses by clutch of feathers. And the last one's called Smoke. Smoke curls up black walls, blending the knife from movement. Its brush soaks my brow. Pretty gets better every Fiona Reardon is next. Fiona Reardon.
This is about train stations. Danish pastries remind me of train stations, waiting hungry, temporary fed, tired ribs of the wooden bench digging into my own ribs, my own spine. The rattle of luggage wheels, handbags thumping against the pinstripe sides, and a congregation of keys hopping rhythmically off the hip. Somewhere a small child sliding his feet, on the shiny lino, pretending to ice skate behind his mother and father in his traveling clothes, all soft in anoraks and beige pants and worn shoes. And there's always someone asking for the bathroom or queuing for it. Sides torn up like tissues by their tired feet, yawns caught like heaving things in the spaces above their heads. Small riblets of spilled coke chasing between toilets. The only people smiling are those who just arrived, soft in a bundle of duffel coats, jackets, t-shirts, and the arms of the waiting ones, who end up spinning into the infinite. The sounds of the station now held mute on the other side of the glass.
Look all dismayed, now I'm Crimea River, carve a limit alone. There ain't no man in this world that I could expect to get tired to lay by
then ask, what is the sound of shit happening? Hindus say, this shit has happened before and before and before and before. Islam says, if shit happens, it is the will of Allah. Catholics say, if shit happens, you deserve it. On account of original sin. Some Anglicans might say, let shit happen to other people. Others might say, let's form a committee to discuss it. Presbyterians say, shit is predestined to happen. Some Jews might say, why does this shit always happen to us? Jehovah's Witnesses might say, let me in your door and I'll tell you why shit happens. Agnostics might say, what is this shit? And atheists say, I don't give a fuck about this shit.
Thank you, Mr. Niall. And while we're plugging books, there's a couple of his up here if you want to take a gander at them later. Next up we have Kevin Mullaney.
I was going to talk to a friend about Bahia and he started talking about Freud, and he said that something about how subconsciously they attach sexual men are subconsciously attached to their mothers. And later Freudian thinkers started to think saying the idea that homosexual men were subconsciously attracted to themselves, and my reaction to that was, what if you have really low self-esteem? So I wrote this poem about that. Oh, to be with another me, we'd laugh and joke all day, drink coffee and go to mass on Sundays. And when the setting sun cooled her skin, I'd know he too wanted to feel the warmth of mine, for I want his. Oh, to be with another me, and run round in the nips when he's as frost outside, or heaters flicker on occasion, and the heat gets sucked into the walls. I need not be modest, for I don't care for his existence. Oh, to be with another me, I'd know what to kiss and when, where, and what pleasure we both get from knowing what not to kiss or not to touch or not to say when we want to begin. Oh, to be with another me and hold our hands in the park and know not to worry what he really thinks about this public display, because I myself feel no shame. We have a picnic with Prosecco and strawberries, and no, he too knows the irony of romance, and we laugh and cringe. Oh, to be with another me, and forget to meet for lunch, but this will not matter, for I know he too cared more for time alone. When I feel more often now for not engaging in love, all okay, for well I know he will feel the same in my direction. I will be with another me, and I can't bear the sight of him. And his coffee is when I can no longer stand the constant questioning, his nervous laughter and his laziness, the full okay for all I see, he all the same.
Okay, and next up we have Christy. Christy Parker,
who we also have above. Thank you. I'm actually in overpaying a cost for time tonight. So I'll cut the poems in half and just do one poem for you and I'll keep the other one for next week. But yeah, it's not the poems that I like, it's the introductions. Cheltenham, England tomorrow. I've sort of focused on a hockey team, and this reminds me of one of life's most perennial lessons. Don't ever dream in a betting shop. About 2 or 3 years ago, I walked into a betting shop in York, where they allow me to live. And sports living champion jockey, Kieran Fallon, he won't mind me saying that, he's not here. And in a 7 furlong race, I think 2 furlongs ahead, and then conspired to lose, which is an incredible achievement in its own way, because any fucker could have won the race, but to lose it for 2 furlongs clear, reinforces the lesson, don't ever dream in a betting shop. Alright? This poem is called Kieran Fallon Owes Me 20 Quid. The end. The word came down from Galway from a man we know as Bert, that Hungry Harry in the 415 was nailed down surefire and certain. A steering job, a dropping pull, a cause to celebrate, take 4-1, an empty post, for we know it can't be bait. When pocket 1 was empty, pocket 2 was bare, pockets 3 and 4 had just 20 cents to spare. The open marriage at 3:30 when walking past the dev, the morning of, two kennels were negotiated from a drunken man called Kev. The money on then milled around as I allowed myself to dream of subtle changes to my life resulting from Bert's scheme. I could almost taste the T-bone steak with eyes just far on prey, washed down not with Gary Lee but with vintage Beaujolais. Tomorrow morning I could be T-shirt for just an hour, puff the line on the sun-based, this is what Bertie's saying. Did my face immerse in flower. And as the starter sent them off, I pictured at my ease how my new threads would turn their heads that night in the pub called the Keys. Those joys of mine were looking fine as Harry set the pace. Was the champion jockey on his back, this would be a one-horse race. I watched him steer the 5 lengths clear, and soon it stretched to 7, as the bookie smelled disaster and the punter scented heaven. 4 furlongs gone, 4 more to go, the field was under rack. Already saddened on the jolly, glanced behind his back. I figured I might opt for salmon, and let the T-bone pass. As I followed Fallon with his apple pie and his foot upon the gas. Into the straight, the horses gave and tight the little frown. It appeared just for a moment there, like he was slowing down. Perhaps the field was gaining, but they'd left it half too late. Then Fallon looks around again, surely not, a falling out, 6 lengths to the good. Then marked their brakes and scrubbed a pack in a horse called Robin Hood. Fallon lost his marbles, his Harry winding down, as marked our gains with every stride, and we're a fucking clown! But my choice of good advice falls only on deaf ears, as like your Duffy in the summer, the big league disappears. At 1/2 a furlong is 2 lengths, yet Fallon doesn't mind. This 5 jockeys now within reach of pinching his behind. Robin Hood goes storming past, the others having mastered. Fallon's fourth should go to court, the good-for-nothing bastard. No T-bone steak went down my throat, no sweet wine passed my lips. I could only dream of how they taste as I ate my bag of chips.
The open mic readers. We have time for possibly one more if there's somebody who has not read yet. Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, maybe we shall call it a night.
Oh, yeah.
Hello, poor. Sometimes when I play fingers over strings, oh no, sorry, that's wrong, I'll start again then. That's called home term. Sometimes when I play fingers over heart, melody melding body with woodland air, I dream of your eyes listening to my tune. In a room the two of us suspended, smiling, while time dances. Sometimes when I sit knitting, slipping wool over steel, I weep heart into sleep and think to see my dreams together. I reel lines of serendipity from me to you, from blue to green to red, purple, violet intensity. In secret, I breathe your name. Now that I lay me down to the tune of you, to the sound of you, I've forgotten, sorry, okay, so, now that I lay me down to the sound of you, to the tone and tune of you, I swoon to know your heart more, and start to allow myself believe in the strings of dreams that I have woven, that the door stands open, and you will walk through, for sometimes when I dream of love, I dream days and nights of you.
Okay, following we have the Crane Lane Actors, right? Woo-hoo! Keep coming. Thank you. Come next week for Noon and the Golden. Thank you. Okay. And,